And here we are on this Tuesday morning with Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater, bringing Carolina coast to coast and the speakeasy to your doorstep. But unfortunately this morning, we're bringing it to your doorstep minus Claudio. He was called away on the last minute with some business that he just could not escape from, much to his regret. And he wanted to make sure I told everybody out there he misses you and he's really sorry he's not going to be able to talk with Harold Siegel, who's going to be our call-in guest today. And he's also missing being with Tyson Laney and meeting him, who is a long, long, long time friend of Harold. And there'll be more about that in a minute. Anyway, we've opened the doors. We're chugging along without Claudio this morning, and he better get back here next week because we need him. And the doors are open, and we're inviting you all to come in as you are, find a seat, and get comfortable in the place where you're always welcome and can always expect the very best. And before we go any further, I also want to mention the Carolina Theater and thank them for their support of WCOM and this fantastic show. The Carolina Theater is an historic nonprofit performing arts complex located at 309 West Morgan Street, Durham, North Carolina, 27701. It is dedicated to presenting vibrant, thought-provoking film. In fact, I think they have just or are in the process of doing the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival right now. And presenting live performances that contribute to the cultural and economic vitality of downtown Durham and the Triangle region. They've been undergoing a great renovation for the last month or so, and will probably not be putting their events on until next month, until September. But you go to their website, www.carolinatheater.org, for information, or call them at 919-560-3030. Or as somebody said, O is a letter, 3030. Anyway, good morning, and I want to welcome Tyson Laney, who is a realtor and bluegrass musician, who's sitting in with us this morning to make sure I don't go off the proven track all here all by myself without Claudio.
Good morning, Otis.
Yeah, so glad you're here, Tyson. You're the one that suggested that we have Harold Siegel on, and he seems like a fascinating man. He's going to be calling in at about 10 minutes after 10. So while we're waiting for him, why don't I put you on the hot spot and ask you, well, talk to me about how you met Harold to start with and the music you played together, because you talked about doing that years ago. And
sure. Harold and I became friends at least 50 years ago.
Wow.
And back they called it junior high school then. Mm-hmm. I suppose it's middle school now.
Mm-hmm.
And we became friends and later became involved in a bluegrass group a folk group. I'll use our friend Tommy Edwards' line. He says that James Taylor has termed this the folk scare of the 60s.
So. Your group was the folk scare?
Well, it was certainly a scare, I'll tell you that. But Harold's a...
How old were you then?
Well, I was 17, uh-huh. I guess. We were probably 17 years
okay.
old. So the last couple of years in high school, we played together and
uh-huh.
played at the Hebert Hayes Memorial Youth Jamboree and
uh-huh.
such, the Rhododendron Festival,
all right.
such places. So it was much fun.
Uh-huh.
And
you were playing guitar, banjo? Or
I was playing guitar.
Guitar, which you still do.
Which I, mm-hmm. I do, yes. Mm-hmm. And we had a girl singer with us, mm-hmm. a beautiful blonde, and mm-hmm. we felt like we
were... Go ahead.
We felt like we were... we sort of modeled ourselves after Peter, Paul, and Mary,
uh-huh.
you know, back then, and did a lot of their songs. And it's just a great deal of fun.
Well, tell me, what is the difference, or is there a difference between what you call folk and bluegrass?
Well, they're
pretty much
similar in a
yeah.
lot of ways, and you know, our own Leroy Savage here, and
mm-hmm.
and Tommy Edwards, you'll hear them do some of the folk songs in the bluegrass context. And as a matter of fact, Leroy is known as the father of Newgrass, so he,
oh, really?
He does a lot of Dylan or Dylan tunes, and as Tommy does.
Right.
You know, they do a show together here in, or actually in Durham.
Right.
And you'll hear a lot of that out of Leroy. So it sort of flows back and forth.
It goes back and forth. Because I've heard it, bluegrass, described as southern folk. So I don't know. Because, I like the music, but I don't know, you know, what the boundaries are or how to label it.
Well, there's actually not a lot of boundaries now. Mm-hmm. You hear so many great musicians, but they are the first generation where people like Bill Monroe, who's known as the father of bluegrass, and people like Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs, really, they were famous prior, but, you know, they did the Beverly Hillbillies.
Right,
And did that theme song, which was Foggy Mountain Breakdown. So a lot of people became familiar with it for that reason, and especially the movie Bonnie and Clyde. You know, they, I said Foggy Mountain Breakdown for the Hillbillies, but it was actually the Hillbilly Tune. But there were a number of songs that really, really put them out there in front of, like, the, for instance, the Dillards, the Darlings that came to town on the Andy Griffith Show were bluegrass musicians, still are. They're in the Hall of Fame, of course.
So this has been your love, your musical love, since way back.
It has.
Since the beginning, right?
It has, since the beginning.
I think we're getting some blinking here that says we might have Harold on the phone. Good morning. This is WCOM. You're live on the air. Is this Harold?
It is.
Hooray!
Audrey.
Yes, I'm so glad that our connection worked and you're here. I've got Tyson in the studio with me.
That's scary.
Well, he's been telling me long tales about you, so I don't know.
Don't believe anything he says.
Yeah, I told him you would say that. Anyway, just to introduce you to our listeners, Harold Siegel is an environmental civic and environmental lawyer from Asheville who is a motorcycle and car racer, as well as being an old-time buddy of Tyson's who sang and played the guitar. So you've got quite a history, Harold.
Well,
so we're going to grill you.
It's been quite an adventure, and I'm still trying to find what I'm good at. I've not found it yet.
Well, from some of the things that I've read, you're pretty good at racing, to start with. You've broken a number of records.
And bones.
And bones, really. Well, I was, in checking back on this, looking at the fact that you have broken the land speed record on an Indian motorcycle.
That's true. Yes, it is.
Going 90 miles an hour? Or 90, actually, 91 point something?
Approximately 94.812.
That's very approximate.
But the top speed of this motorcycle from the factory in 1937. Mm-hmm. It's a 1937 Indian Scout. The top speed posted from the factory was 56 miles per hour.
Wow.
So, I mean, it doesn't sound very fast, but it's you know, on a hand shift, foot clutch motorcycle made in 1937 that has no rear suspension at all. Mm-hmm. The front suspension is a shock absorber about the size of a tube of lipstick, so it's like a bicycle with a motor, and doing everything it can to spit you off the entire time you're on it. So it's quite an adventure, and to get it to that speed, I mean, this is a conventional configuration, essentially stock bike. So we're doing okay. We're working to get it to 100 miles per hour. And I think we're going to make it.
Wow. So you're still riding the, is it that same particular bike? Or
Yes, that same one. Uh-huh. It's, we have some other things we race, but you know, that Indian is sort of a special little motorcycle.
Well, there's a number of things I'd like to talk about, including how you went from law school into motorcycle racing and environmental law. But one of the things, because I'm not very knowledgeable about motorcycles, but I have heard about the Indian. Mm-hmm. What is so special about this old bike with a motor on it that tries to spit you off?
Well, it's I suppose it's more just the vintage. You know, it sort of represents a place in our history, like Tyson. Tyson's a lot older than me.
I think I understand you went to high school together.
Maybe
a year younger than you are.
Well, maybe a little bit.
Maybe. Yeah. I'm going to catch up on this, Mr. Lawyer.
Just practicing.
Okay.
But it's a special machine, mm-hmm. and it does represent a place in our history. You know, these bikes were made. They're still. I think they may still be remaking them. You know, someone's using the name and making new motorcycles. Mm-hmm. But the real Indians were made from. You know, they started making them in 1901.
That's what I was going to ask you about. Were they the ones that they used in the First World War?
Yes.
Okay, because I had an uncle who didn't live long enough for me to ever meet him, who was a dispatch rider.
My goodness.
On a motorcycle.
Wow.
Between the lines, then.
Well, that would have been the Indian he was riding.
That would have been the Indian. So I could see where it has some sort of magic to it.
Oh, they are magic. Uh-huh. And, they were, represented a part of our history. And actually, if anyone follows motorcycle racing and current road racing, the Isle of Man races, which are world famous, have been running there since 1907. The Indians won the first three places at the Isle of Man motorcycle races in 1911.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like they were really special race bikes at the time.
Right.
I mean, that's another day, another time, but it's nice to be able to bring those things back and make them work well. And as it turns out, it's lots of fun. And riding that little thing at in land speed racing, it's a standing start 1 mile run, but it's every bit as exciting as going around Daytona at 170 miles an hour on a superbike. It's just different. It's a very mm-hmm. different experience, but it's lots of fun, and we really enjoy it.
Do you race the super bikes too, or just the Indian?
Yes.
How you doing?
Well, I have done. Uh-huh. I still have one of those bikes, and we'll probably do some land speed racing with it. But as far as road racing the motorcycles, I did that for many years,
uh-huh.
and. Actually, after the last time I ran Daytona, what you'd call it when you crash a motorcycle when you're racing is falling off.
Oh.
It's sort of a
you hope
friendly,
you just fall free of it.
I mean, it's sort of a gentle, benign description of something that's usually not very benign or
right.
gentle.
Right.
But I fell off at Daytona.
Mm-hmm.
It's not too long ago, and the wonderful folks at Time Warner who've sponsored me through the years, the division president who was looking after things at the time, at Time Warner, I did have to have a little surgery after that crash. I actually raced the next day and finished third, but,
mm-hmm.
Did some damage to a shoulder. He said, Harold, maybe at your age you should be racing something you can't fall off of. So I didn't take that too seriously, but I did take the opportunity to, get them enlisted in helping us race a car. So we started racing an old 911 Porsche rally car at that point. I took him up on it. So, and we actually, we've won the Targa, Newfoundland twice since then.
Twice? Okay, because I thought that was almost three times, but I guess I read
we won it twice. We
okay.
We were last in the division last time.
Okay.
And the first time we ran, we actually, I didn't have a license to race in this. I mean, it's like another country, and a whole new, different kind of racing. But they let
some
me race
lawyer. It. He's racing without a license.
They let me. Well, I had a motorcycle racing license.
Okay.
And I mean, I was there.
Right.
I mean, I was in Newfoundland.
Right.
You know, with the car. What are they going to do? I mean, it's like, hey, you don't think I came all this way for nothing? So they did let us run,
mm-hmm.
And because of a wonderful job that Stan Pendergraft, the navigator, did. I mean, he was with me. It's the first time either of us had run this race, but Stan's an incredible guy. Got a great sense of direction, and since he was looking down at the instructions the entire race, he didn't get to see out the windshield and get scared like I was since I was driving. But going through this process, we actually finished every stage in the race under the trophy time. And we got a trophy, you know, we got this like silver plate
mm-hmm.
because we finished everything under trophy time. But there was someone that actually was a bit faster than we were and,
uh-huh.
and won the class. But, you know, we went back next 2 years, we won it. So, and ended up getting a gold plate for running. We ran a series of 3 years, never going over trophy time.
All right. So you basically went from motorcycles to a car because you couldn't fall off it?
Well, if you say it that way.
Well, he can fall off a car.
He can fall off a car. That's when he's in a convertible and he's standing up and driving it that way.
Exactly.
Just seeing how fast he can go standing up in a convertible.
Well, I'm sure if it can be done, Tyson can make it happen. No, but it wasn't just that. But, yeah, it is a bit more gentle,
mm-hmm.
and the motorcycles do, I mean, it's such fun, and it's always been something I felt like I could do without, you know, doing any unnecessary damage to myself. I always felt comfortable with it, and...
Well, it's something that as a parent of a number of children, most of whom or a few of whom, I have seven kids, were enamored of motorcycles. And my feeling was, if we're going to have a motorcycle, I'm going to wrap a mattress around you before I let you ride it.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, because it's, you know, there is your precious out there on this instrument with all those big cars around without much protection.
Well, that's the mothering instinct, which
yeah,
is a wonderful thing. It's permitted us to survive, you know, all these years on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a good thing. In fact, I got to experience some of that the first time I went to Newfoundland to race there in this cross-country race. Having suggested that I do it, took about 6 weeks to get over here at home with my wife. I mean, she didn't react as well as I had hoped she might. But, you know, since it was going from motorcycle racing to racing cars, it gave me an advantage. So
uh-huh.
I had a leg up on that.
Right.
But without it having any even thought about it, I suggested to her, after she adjusted to the notion of me doing it, that I might take our son Mark to navigate for me. And
uh-huh.
I didn't realize I hit a nerve. I mean,
right.
She just went ballistic.
Right.
What are you talking about? I said, well, I don't know. I was talking about Mark going with me to, you know, to navigate
mm-hmm.
or drive. I'll navigate. And she didn't like the idea of both of us being in
right.
a car.
Right.
Which we couldn't fall off of, but
right.
it didn't matter to her.
Yes. Well, when did this racing business start? I know, from Tyson, that you were both in the Navy.
Yes.
And then you came back, and I guess you went to the law school after the Navy?
Yes, that's
And
right.
you went right here at UNC Law School, is that right?
UNC, yeah.
Well, where and when? I mean, were you racing your motorcycle around Chapel Hill Carver? What was your transportation in law school?
Well, actually, my transportation there was a Chevrolet pickup.
Okay.
Which is just an old farm truck,
uh-huh.
But a great truck. I wish I had it now. Yeah. It was a great thing. And we lived at Lakeview Mobile Home Court, which you cannot find now.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was out on Weaver Dairy Road.
Uh-huh.
And loved the place. We had a little fishing pond at the bottom of the hill. Took
Neat.
The son down there fishing. But anyway, that's how we got back and forth. And I was a non-traditional student. I'd
mm-hmm.
been around for a while. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, being through the Navy. But as far as the motorcycles, I was riding off-road bikes there. There were race bikes. We were doing a lot of off-road riding. And there were a couple of other students and some locals who were very much involved in off-road racing and rode with them.
You started with the...
yes, essentially, yeah.
Okay, that was about when you had your first motorcycle, or...?
No, I'd had motorcycles
okay.
before, but that was the first, you know, I'd started, you know, actually with the race bikes then.
Right.
That was my first broken bone. Or,
uh-huh.
Yeah, and I had a shoulder injury there. But, you know, it was okay. As
okay.
it turned out, it...
You didn't need that bone anyway.
Well, actually, you don't.
Okay.
I didn't know you really don't. We've got lots of extra bones in our body. I didn't know it at the time.
Right,
but
right. You found out since, the hard way.
Yeah. I don't know that they're actually unnecessary, but you can get by without them.
Mm-hmm. Well... Okay, so you're starting racing, you're in law school, and you're going into, did you decide then that it was environmental law was one of your interests, or did that come later?
Well, I would have to say it came later.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have all these fanciful notions, you know, when you're younger about things you might do, and in fact, I've never got over having all those fanciful notions about things I might do tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's still sort of a part of our life.
Good.
Tyson and I talk a lot about things like that. But, you know, then there was such a wide open arena for
mm-hmm.
things in law. It was a very active time, lots of things going on, and lots of things in environmental law.
Mm-hmm.
There were new laws being passed, and you know, I graduated.
I'm just going to say, is that in doing a little research ahead of time on this? It's they say 1970 was the environmental law, the Clean Air, Clean Water Acts that came along.
Well, that's that was the era when a lot of
right.
this was happening. Like
okay.
the Toxic Substances Control
mm-hmm.
Act was enacted in 1976.
Mm-hmm.
That's the name of it. It's the Toxic Substances Control Act of 1976,
mm-hmm.
which tells you that before 1976, we didn't have any of those problems.
Yeah,
there were no toxic substances in 1975. But in 1976, we got right on it.
Uh-huh.
Some, you know, they came along and we passed a law to regulate them.
It was interesting to me that prior to this, as you just said, there weren't these laws, and I'm just assuming that they had always been there, so there was nothing legally protecting our environment before that era or that time period. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
Nothing legally. But
right.
I think that's where we have to come to grips with the reality of
mm-hmm.
this, and after 1976, we ought not be laboring under the impression that it's okay now. You know, now that that law was passed, it's
right.
okay. You know, nobody does that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
When you back away and look at the big picture and realize where we really are, we come to realize that even though we've recognized the problem and we've created some legal mechanism to deal with the problem, dealing effectively with that problem with limited resources is
mm-hmm.
very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really back to where we always were, and that is taking responsibility for looking after our world,
mm-hmm.
You know, our own little space and the world as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And we then realize, hey, okay, there are legal requirements, but way above that, way beyond that, are the moral and ethical requirements that we all have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have them from our birth, we live with them, and we die with them. We do have responsibilities, and that is where we fail in some cases.
Well, you would think that the law or the, you know, the rules and regulations should be tools of that moral responsibility.
They are,
mm-hmm.
but they are ineffective if we
right.
don't honor them.
Right,
it's like the Ten Commandments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't really have to go back and check them periodically. Oh, I can't remember. Was there anything wrong with that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not like we forget that it's wrong to lie, it's wrong to steal or to kill.
Mm-hmm.
We know, but the fact that we acknowledge it as a society and we say, hey, this is the way we're going to live. We're going to live together. These are the rules. These are the things we're going to do to honor each other's space. Yeah, once we do that, it gives it some more clarity. It gives it some more ring of sincerity. But still, the real tools that we have to work with are moral and ethical. They're not legal.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a way of identifying and dealing with the problem.
But there is, because of the laws, there is legal action that an individual can take. To work against environmental harm they might be experiencing?
Well, yes.
There's a way to go?
there is a way to go.
Mm-hmm.
It's sometimes a difficult way. It's often difficult, often
mm-hmm.
challenging, but when we, I suppose, when we experience personally a problem,
mm-hmm.
say from pollution, say we live in an area and the water, you know, we're on well and that well water's polluted, you know, it's poisoned by something. we then, you know, go out and look around and say, well, what can we do? And we realize there's, you know, in environmental law, there's sort of, you know, I guess two areas that, you know, in very general terms that we deal with. One is the control of and remediation of these things that happen, and then there's conservation laws. You know, there are laws or regulations that would regulate what you do. So in one arena, you have, you know, Congress passing laws that say, or the state, you know, state government has laws as well. All the states do. They will pass a law and say, thou shalt not put PCBs in the ground,
mm-hmm.
or in water, or these chemicals, whatever the chemicals are. And that can be regulated, can be monitored, can be checked on a regular basis by their limited governmental resources, and that is a tool to keep that from happening. But when it happens, even though that law's there, then what do? At that point, you go into this other arena of, you know, remediation or
mm-hmm.
remedies that come from that. And, you know, the Gulf is a pretty good example of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're working in the Gulf now. I've been working with a great friend in Texas, in Dallas, Scott Summey, who's now at Barron and Budd. We've worked together on environmental law for many years, and we're now working on a lot of cases in the Gulf with the BP spill, the
mm-hmm.
The Deepwater Horizon release there in 2010, violated the Oil Pollution Act of 1990.
Mm-hmm.
But as we look at, you know, the situation that occurs, you say, well, that you violated regulation. Well, sure they did.
Mm-hmm.
But then we start to see the limitations on that. You know, in fact, the federal law in that case says that your maximum liability is, what, I think it's $75 million, the cap, on the liability that the person responsible for that release can be held responsible for.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that shows you that law sometimes can be political.
Mm-hmm.
It sometimes can help us. It sometimes can hurt us.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on who's making the laws. And the people that make the laws sometimes can be determined by the folks that have a financial interest in the laws they're going to make. I know that's a big surprise to everybody, but it can happen, and it does. Uh-huh. So what we see then is when you look to the government, if we believe that the law is going to protect us, this regulatory law, we say, well, wait a minute. In this case, it didn't help. It's really a limitation on us. It's really, and if it's a detriment to those who are harmed, it becomes a benefit to those who did the harm. I mean, that's just the other side of the coin. I mean, that may be a strange way to look at it or describe it. I never really thought about it until until I said it just then. But
write it down quick before you lose it.
Yeah, I'll never remember. But that's what we end up with. And then you say, well, now what do I do? Then you have to look at what other legal mechanisms are available, because that's really, we're relegated to the courts. Our judicial system is how we correct wrongs. Mm-hmm. So that's where lawyers come into play, and you know, folks come to you and say, can you help us with this? We've suffered great harm, and you know, will you help us? And that's where there's such a great opportunity for lawyers who want to be involved, who want to help, who are willing to go through the
rigors.
There are stronger words for it, but yeah, rigors is a good word.
Okay, I
can see why you do radio.
Yes.
That's a good word. Yeah, rigors. Those things. Yeah, that. That's what you go through. Mm-hmm. But still, you know, you have these great opportunities. On occasion, sometimes a few times in a lifetime, that you can actually go in and make something happen. You can actually go in and make things better. You can help someone who would not have been helped otherwise, who could find no way to go, and you were able to help them. And that's a good thing. So,
you
and
were
that's
working
one of the ways
with the firm that worked on what became the movie Erin Brockovich. Is that correct?
Yes.
Right.
Oh, yeah, we did a number of cases together.
Right. And that's a case where there was a battle for an individual.
But
I guess all your cases don't turn into movies.
Most of them, but yeah. You know,
that's where you get your residuals from.
Yeah, really. That's how I make
retirement living. Retirement fund.
That's where all my grocery money comes from.
Yeah,
you know.
Right.
I wish. No.
But you're acting at, you are a trial lawyer.
Yes.
Right. And so you yourself in an email said, what is it like to be a professional fighter or a hired gun? So, from a motorcycle racer who's breaking land speed races on 1937 motorcycles to being a legal hired gun, I mean, what's the tie-in there?
Well, I suppose if you look at what people do, I think they tend to create patterns, and they tend to do the same things or enjoy the same sorts of things in several different walks of their life in different aspects. And you know, the trial work is something that, it's always been enjoyable. I know it's awfully stressful, and some folks don't do well with that stress. Some people are sort of immune to it, and some people just really thrive on it. And I think folks who do trial work, who enjoy that, have to have some appreciation for the challenge and for the uncertainty. You know, there's always uncertainty in a trial. Most things that happen, you have anticipated, but there's always something that happens that you didn't anticipate. Like,
is that
a witness.
One of the similarities of racing?
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. And but to know that those possibilities are there, to know that you're going to be facing challenges that you really can't get your arms around at the outset, but knowing that if you prepare well, if you anticipate as best you can all the things that might happen, and prepare yourself to deal with those uncertainties and those challenges. It's a great satisfaction to get through that process and to do it successfully. You know, in a trial, to get a jury verdict that that honors the rights of your client is a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like crossing the finish line, seeing the checkered flag, and still being upright.
Mm-hmm.
and too, there's a lot of things about the trial of cases and dealing with the other lawyers. I mean, you know that you're all there to represent your client, even the bad guys, as we sometimes call them, the guys that represent the oil companies and all these other big bad companies that we have to fight. We know that they're there to do their job, and they're going to do their job, and they do it very well. And although they're there to compete, they're there to win, they're not going, and we expect this among our brethren at the bar, we are not going to shoot each other in the back. We're not going to do things that dishonor our profession. We're not going to do what we do in a malicious way that is designed to do harm. We're going to do what we do professionally, and we're going to do it well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing on a racetrack. I mean, when you're out there road racing, when you're at Daytona on the banks and you're bumping elbows with somebody at 160, 170 miles an hour, you want to believe that they're as capable as you are, and you hope that you're as capable as they are, but you're all looking to win the race, but you also know that no one out there is going to do you harm
mm-hmm.
in order to win the race.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you develop and appreciate this sense of trust and appreciation for those with whom you share this adventure, this effort. You're all sharing in this. You're all a part of it. Everybody wants to win, but no one's going to do you harm. And that's a great comfort, but it's also a great responsibility. And that responsibility translates into how you treat others in a courtroom,
mm-hmm.
on a racetrack, or in school, or wherever else you are. There's just lots of life lessons to learn. The fact that racing bikes don't have rear view mirrors is just a great philosophical comment to me. they don't. And you
uh-huh.
can't see what's going on behind you. You
right.
do not know what's going on behind you. It causes you to try to increase your peripheral vision. You go through these exercises so you can, get a better look at what's going on beside you. But
there are exercises for that?
Yes, uh-huh.
How
there
about
are.
That? I've
yeah.
been told I have great peripheral vision. I need to learn how to focus on something in front of me.
you should race motorcycles.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
If I'm going to race anything, it's going to be a tank.
Well, that inability to focus is probably the reason I race motorcycles and cars and try to make music and do all these other things. But it makes life fun.
Well, in the article that was in the Lawyers Weekly, you talked about using racing. This was particularly car racing. I think they were talking about your the need for speed, how that is better for you and more enjoyable than going out and playing golf, because by the end of the time that you've been playing golf, you would have been getting so stressed because of all the other things that you should be doing.
Really?
And that in racing, you don't have the time to think, well, oh, gee, I need to call this person and I need to file that thing, and because you've got to make sure you stay alive by the finish line.
Yeah, it's absolutely true.
Uh-huh.
And it is golf. It's a beautiful sport,
mm-hmm.
and I really like people who play golf. They're usually really nice people. They're very articulate. They dress nice. They drive nice cars.
Uh-huh.
Live in nice houses, and they usually live around some country club.
Uh-huh.
And they won't let you ride dirt bikes on their golf course. So, that's but they're really nice folks,
uh-huh.
and I'm glad they're out there. They're part of God's creation,
mm-hmm.
and I'm glad that they do what they do. And when I've played golf before, I really enjoyed it. It's beautiful surroundings, all the things you see on television about golf. But it is so slow and so ill-focused. I mean, it just, I mean, you get to focus just occasionally on hitting the ball, and then the way I play golf, the rest of my time I'm in the woods looking for the ball. But the time that I'm there, you know, after 18 holes, I've had so much time to stand around and think. I thought, well, I wonder if I got that file. I wonder, you know, I think this judge wanted me to call him, and I don't think I did. And by the time I'm through standing around there all day long without a phone and without anything to write on, I've got all this just checklist in my head of things I need to do, and I'm just anxious to get back home or the office to do these things.
You mean they don't have any place where you can race golf carts?
I'd never thought about that. It's a wonderful idea. That is a great idea.
You just mentioned not having anything to ride. There's the secret.
Yeah. But, yeah, but and when you're racing, you know, when you're away racing, you are totally occupied. Your attention is totally devoted to what is before you. And, you know, when you're on a bike particularly, or a car either, I mean, you know, when you're racing at a limit. And when you're running at the limit, and something that can hurt you, or on something that can hurt you, or that you can fall off of, as my Time Warner friend told me. When you're at that point, you can't think about anything else. So you don't have to feel guilty about not thinking about, well, I should have written this way, or I could have phrased that in a different way, and it would have been more convincing. You can't think about any of that. So you excuse yourself. I mean, you know, it's like I can give myself that time away from thinking about these other things, because if I do think about them, I might kill myself. So with that comfort of not being permitted to think about those things, I can just relax. And I can actually sit in the pits between races and sleep. I can, I mean, it is just so restful to me.
Well, it's somebody once said, or I read somewhere, that a vacation is the absolute break in your normal routine. So you could say you're taking a vacation every time you go racing.
Oh, yeah. I've never heard that, but it's really true. It's a wonderful
thought.
So
it doesn't necessarily have to be, I'm going to Paris, or I'm doing this, that, or the other thing. Is you know, I am going to be doing something entirely different.
Yeah. So that is absolutely true.
But you are now, something else that we've got to let people know about, right? Basically, I want to let everybody know you're listening to WCOM 103.5 FM, and we're Claudio Speakeasy, and we're talking with Harold Siegel, who's a motorcycle and car racing environmental litigator, and Tyson Laney, who's a realtor and bluegrass musician. So it's I wanted to bring up the fact that you are listed in the best lawyers in America. So is this like the who's who of the legal profession?
Well, it's actually, I am listed, and it may well be a mistake. There's it's probably a Harold Siegel out there that they meant to have in there, and I really feel sorry for this guy, but I'm not looking for him.
Okay.
I'll take advantage of it as long as they keep putting me in there. But you know, it is a good thing. And the reason it's a good thing is because it's not a list put together by anybody except lawyers. It is a listing, and it's a small listing of lawyers in the country who are both nominated and selected by lawyers. And it's like the lawyers who lawyers say, if I had to have someone to represent me, this is the person I would pick. And, you know, it's quite an honor. And I really do appreciate the fact that I'm there, whether it's a mistake or not. I do appreciate it. And that gives me a group of folks, our colleagues who are also in that listing. You know, there's a good bit of communication among them, and it's a really good group. And to be able to call on the very best lawyers across the country and them answer the phone and talk to you is a wonderful privilege,
right.
And I do appreciate that. And it's a good thing.
So you've practiced some of the really big things, you know, working with the issues in the Gulf, and then in the past with other environmental issues, but you've also done admiralty law. I think you mentioned that. What is that?
That admiralty law is shipping. You know, it's mm-hmm. international law, laws of sea, transportation law. Usually, I mean, the admiralty laws lawyers are typically on the coast, and I did practice in Wilmington for 27 years, and that is where I started doing admiralty work when I first went to Wilmington out of law school. Actually, I planned to go there and stay a couple of years and then come back to Asheville, and we, like, forgot to come back. I mean, we stayed there 27 years, and wait a minute. Yeah, we were supposed to go back to Asheville. So we did, but while I was there, this firm did admiralty work, and it was a very, very good firm. That's why I went there. Wonderful people, wonderful client base, and started doing admiralty work. And that turned out to be sort of that part of my life, that part of my history. I did a lot of that. Actually got to be chairman of the Southeast Admiralty Law Institute.
Wow.
And by the time I was at that position, I wasn't doing admiralty law anymore. I was doing environmental law.
Mm-hmm.
And all the while, you know, doing all kinds of other trial work and still doing all kinds of, you know, legal work, including, you know, all kinds of litigation. But that was a really wonderful opportunity for me because it was federal court jurisdiction. Got to do a lot of work in federal court, which is, you know, very good judges, very good bar there. Good group of lawyers, and having all that trial experience, I think, was probably one of the reasons the environmental work came along.
Mm-hmm.
And that experience gave us the opportunity to do those things. And one thing leads to another, and we really never know how
right.
things are going to come out. And in trial law, you just sort of jump in the river and you go where it takes you.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to see the other end of the river.
Mm-hmm.
From wherever you are, so you just got to get in and try to swim and avoid the rocks and hope and pray that you end up in a good place. And thank the Lord, I've been blessed in many ways, and I've found my way to good cases. And you know, if you have a good result, then you get a reputation for being very good at that,
mm-hmm.
whether you are or not. Yeah, you know,
you made it through, so maybe you'll do it again.
If you win a case, and you know, then you get to win some more, and then
mm-hmm.
you know, all of a sudden people think you're good. And but it's okay. I mean, you move along and you take a case, and every time, I mean, your job is simply to make sure that you do everything possible to help your client accomplish their purpose, you know, do what they want to do. If it's a contest, a fight, you know, you do your best to accomplish for them what they want within the realm of reality. And when you go into the street to fight, you know, you don't want to do unnecessary harm to the other side. You don't want your client to be harmed, so...
Mm-hmm.
You know, first thing you're looking for is to see if you're carrying a .45 or a BB gun
mm-hmm.
before you walk out into the street
mm-hmm.
and try to do the right thing, giving due weight to what to the strength of your case.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the transition from admiralty to environmental finally came full circle in the Gulf, as it turns out. I mean, that's
yeah.
the, you know, Oil Pollution Act of 1990 and. You know, a great environmental, a horrible, I don't mean great, a good,
right,
horrible
right.
environmental disaster, which involves admiralty law and environmental law,
mm-hmm.
all comes together. So it's sort of a full circle for me.
And well, what would you think that the public and our listeners and people out there need to do? How can people educate themselves as to the process of ensuring that our environment is not totally destroyed?
Well, I think certainly to look and see what the laws are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and now you can research so easily. You know, you can just go on the internet, and any number of search engines will take you to an environmental law area. If you just put in environmental law, I mean,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure you're going to get lots of information. But if you have a particular interest in a particular thing, you can refine that search go to the governmental agencies, you know, the government websites, and look for their environmental regulatory authorities, their agencies. And, you know, I'm talking now about the regulatory side. And if you have harm, you know, you're going to be looking to the regulatory side to see who's there, who was monitoring this, did they monitor it, and what can they do about it. But I think if, you know, if you're looking at your responsibility in business or in industry or as a, you know, just as a citizen and doing recycling,
mm-hmm.
you can look and you can find very easily through your government websites or governmental websites what you can and can't do, what you should and should not do to protect the environment. And then when you do have things that occur, it's somewhat difficult to find lawyers who are experienced in helping those who have suffered mm-hmm. from environmental contamination. A lot of the environmental lawyers, in quotes, represent industry, represent, you know, the companies that are involved in these processes, because they have to have lawyers to help them with the regulatory
right.
requirements, you know, the filling out of application, satisfaction of governmental standards. So there's a lot of lawyers who work in that realm, but the ones who work in the realm of helping those who have been hurt and who have suffered damage and to recover, they're somewhat harder to find, but they're out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, how would you find them? Is there a directory somewhere? Or would they just type in Google environmental lawyer, North Carolina, if we wanted to find you?
Well, if you want to find me, it's just Harold Siegel. Yeah, SeaEagleRacing.com.
Yeah, we wanted to, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was on my list of things to let the world out there know that there is SeaEagle Racing.
Actually, it's almost Seagull
right,
Racing,
right.
But it's not. It's really
SeaEagleRacing.com.
Yeah, and the reason it's SeaEagle is because when I was setting up the company that this racing division is a part of, some Seagull already had Seagull Enterprises, so I had to get something else, so I made it SeaEagle.
As it turned out,
it worked well for the racing part. Uh-huh. SeaEagle Racing seemed mm-hmm. kind of neat. The only trouble is nobody can find it because they think it's Siegel. But yeah,
well, I guess if somebody got in touch with, like, let's say, the North Carolina Bar Association,
yes.
they would be able to get some information if they were looking for.
Yes, I was going to suggest that actually. if you do go to the bar, mm-hmm. Even if you find the environmental lawyers that, you know, if you call a law firm, they're listed as doing environmental law work, and you call them and you tell them the kind of problem you have, one thing I think we can really depend on our lawyers, particularly in North Carolina, to do is to let you know. If they're not the one to help you,
mm-hmm.
you know, they will get you, they should. I mean, ask them if they don't volunteer to do it. Ask them to tell you who it is that does the thing that you're asking to be done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they can't do it, I think you can typically expect our lawyers in this state to volunteer that information.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not the one, you know, help the person find the right one. Because ultimately, it's in all our best interest for everyone to be fairly and properly represented
right.
in these matters.
Well, we've got just a few minutes left, and I want to go full circle back to, are you singing and playing the guitar anymore?
oddly enough, about as much as I ever did, and that's not because I'm doing a whole lot now,
uh-huh.
it's because I never did. I mean, as far as the quality of my playing, I can play guitar plenty well enough to entertain myself, and that's
uh-huh.
about the limit.
It looks like Tyson doesn't quite agree with that estimation of your talents. He's shaking his head a little like...
Oh, he can do a fine version of Doc Watson's Deep River Blues. And that's not real easy.
You know, I should have asked this ahead of time, that you have your guitar handy before you come on the air.
Oh, yeah, really. If you had, I would not have volunteered to call you at 10:10. Now, Tyson is, I mean, I hate to say this and him sitting there because I usually don't say anything nice about him when he's around, but Tyson would say something good about anybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's that kind of guy. I've often said if God made a better man than Tyson Laney, he didn't need to because he's good.
That is really sweet. He's blushing.
Well, that's rare. Yeah. Tyson is a great musician. God put music in his heart, and he did, and it comes out, and you can feel it, you can hear it. And he's let me play with him through the years. We played when we were in high school and a bit after that. Even had a job making music one time. And, the group we played with in school, the great thing about it was I didn't have to be a very good guitar player. All I had to do was watch Tyson. I could follow him. Mm-hmm. And Sandra McKinney and Tyson both have voices like angels. Mm-hmm. Tyson's is a kind of a weird angel, but but Sandra had such a beautiful voice. So if I had sang just a little bit softer than everybody else and played just a little bit softer, it seemed like I was making music. And I took full advantage of that. Uh-huh. I just hung out with Tyson, but it was such great fun. And I still play. I still play a good bit. And Tyson actually let me help him on a recording not too long back, which was kind. I mean, he had no need for me to be there playing with him, but he was so kind to invite me to do it, and it was great fun.
I wish I could talk some more with you, and we might just have to do this again sometime in the future because it's been great fun, but we are starting to run out of time, and we've got someone else getting ready to come on at 11 o'clock. So,
good deal.
I want to thank you very much, Harold, for calling in and for sharing your wild and speedy life with us.
Thank you for letting me be a part of it. Both it's been great fun.
And also thank you, Tyson, for coming in.
It's my pleasure. Good
helping
to
getting this whole thing set up and moving it along.
Good to hear from you, Harold.
You too, Tyson.
Take care of me.
See you, brother.
Yes, sir.
See you. Thanks, Art.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And that was Harold Siegel here on Claudio Speakeasy, and we are about ready to sign off so we can give John Paul time to get in here and get his Truth, Quest, and Variety Hour going. Tyson, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Okay, just listen up to a little bit of music, and we'll be back next week.